Session number 23347, Bert, Black Owl, reels 3 and 4. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel interviewer's mic only, assuming the mics are all right. Bert, Black Owl, reel 3.
Now, what the next move was, you left Chelsea Barracks and went to Purbright Barracks. Now, when was that about? I know you're not quite sure, but roughly.
Well, Purbright Barracks, we went there. Let's say it's August. Late August or September.
Okay. What happened when you arrived at Purbright Barracks? Now, did you all go there, or was it just a draft? What happened? Who were you joining?
Well, the amount of people that passed out went there. What would I say? About 20 or two dozen, 24.
And you were still under the second, the Scots Guards training battalion when you
exactly.
went to Purbright. Still training.
This is the other part of our training, like. Using rifles, firing on the ranges, throwing bloody hand grenades, that sort of thing. This is the other part of the training.
Well, let's go through the weapons training.
Yeah.
Let's start with the rifle. How did you learn to fire the Lee Enfield?
Well, we were taken on the firing ranges, laid out on our stomach in the usual positions. We was given one round apiece. We wasn't given five rounds what the magazine carried. We was only just put one round up the spout, as I say, and we were taught how to put that one round in, pointed forward, obviously, but we weren't supposed to know that, and we were taught how to put it in, slide the bolt forward, ram it home, take the safety catch off, and then you was given a target up on the range to fire. They said, we won't tell you what to hit, but try and hit the target. That sort of thing, all that sort of banter went on. But you were taught how to line up the foresight in line, line the foresight up with the V of the rear sight and point at the target, hold it hard into your shoulder, don't wobble, don't mess about, hold it hard into your shoulder, prepare for the kickback and fire. And
What was it like first time?
You done that first time. You did get a kick back and you did get a shock because it was the first time you'd ever fired. But then again, they give you another round and you had another go. Followed the same drill until in the finish, after three rounds, I think it was, single rounds, they give you a cartridge case with five rounds of ammunition in it. And then you were shown how to... It was half round, and they showed you how to put that in so that you didn't have to put every single up the spout that you'd been doing. Each time you put the bolt forward, you pushed a round out of the cartridge case and fired. And you walked down onto the range to have a look at your target. They didn't fetch the target back to you like they do these days. But you see whether you hit the target or not. If you was lucky, there was a couple of holes out of the five rounds that you'd fired, or the three rounds, or there was no holes at all. But I was lucky. I hit the target each time.
Were you a good shot, man?
Wasn't in the ball or in the ring, but in the outer ring. But I was trying. I was trying hard because... I learned about the foresight into the V of the rear sight, or the rear back, whatever they called it. And I liked it, I enjoyed it. Yep. And then another day we'd go on into the butts and throw in hand grenades.
Tell me about that, man, hand grenades. That'd be the Mills bomb, was it?
Yeah, the Mills bombs. You pulled the ring. You held the hand grenade in your right hand. It all depended whether you was left-handed or right-handed. But being right-handed, you held the grenade in your right... These were proper grenades, so they wasn't dummies, and you pulled the pin, threw your arm back, and in a wide heart, you threw it. The same as you'd throw a tennis ball or an ordinary ball or anything like that. But the danger was, with some people, they threw it straight up. Of course, then you had to run, or you was in a shelter anyway. But the aim was to get your arc right and let it go. Then we'd done that two or three times.
Did it make you nervous? Because some people don't like it.
It did. Some of the boys.
Some of them.
Some of the boys were frightened of them because they had seen one go up and come straight back down. But they got used to it, and then he brought the dummies on. For them sort of people, he brought the dummies on, which wasn't explosive. And they were taken away on their own and given, some throws on it with the dummies until they got the arc right. But I don't know why, but I could throw mine bloody tight. Well, it was something dangerous, so I wanted to throw it away. And that's the attitude you had to adopt. You knew it was something dangerous. You couldn't play with these things. They were dangerous. Even the rifle, not like the thing you had at Chelsea Barracks that you couldn't. But these rifles were potent, and you had to remember that. What, and that was filled into you. See, that's where the discipline comes in again.
What about bayonet practice? Bayonet training.
Well, bayonet practice, you come back to the old bag man hanging up by his neck, and you had to be fierce then, and throw out a blood-curdling roar and be as aggressive as you could and go, and stick it right in him, The old phrase comes, you don't like it up them. They use that now on the television, don't they, on the old army game. Yeah, don't like it up them. And you had to really go into it and do all the actions and fierceness but I'd never, in all my army experience, even facing Germans, never ever used a bayonet. Only on them sacks.
Did you think it was a waste of time, the bayonet? Or?
I didn't know, because you do now at my age. It was silly, but that word discipline comes back again. You had to be aggressive. You wasn't a straight up soldier being nice to people. You was a combatant in action, and that sack in front of you was going to kill you if you don't kill him. That was the discipline that was coming out, you see.
Did you learn bayonet, what they call bayonet fencing as well, this business of bringing the butt through and,
Well, that came at later dates in unarmed combat.
No, bayonet fencing, because you wouldn't be, you're not unarmed with a rifle and bayonet.
No, you didn't play around with it.
Right.
You didn't play around with a rifle and bayonet. They was for one use only, on your shoulder, in the proper position when you was marching, or if you want to use them what they was built for, sticking into somebody, but not to play about with like that. The only time you've done anything like that, like with the butt of your rifle and that sort of thing, was unarmed combat.
Right, I've got you. Okay, we'll come back to that.
That was unarmed combat.
What about either the Bren gun or the Lewis gun? I don't know which it was then.
Well, no, that came at a later date.
No light machine.
Lewis gun, yeah, we had the Lewis gun.
Tell me about that then.
But, I can't say much about that because I didn't have much to do with them, because there was a different section, the Lewis gunners.
But you didn't have it at Purbright.
You see, what cut into us at Purbright was the fact that we would be going to come a tank battalion.
And they knew that.
And they knew that. You see, and we would see. Germany was getting away with murder out on the continent with his tanks. The tanks was doing horrific things, going through everything. They was fighting the war and winning everything. And we didn't have a tank. We had the artillery, But we had very few tanks. So what some nice gentleman thought of was that the elite force that we had, which was the guards, turn them into a tank division, a tank. So you had the Six Guards Tank Brigade was formed, and we were all shipped off then to Codford St Mary.
Now, anything else about, before we go on to that, anything else about your training at Purbright? You've done the rifle, hand grenades, bayonet. What else? Any other training?
Purbright, we had a villain.
Tell me about that.
We had a villain, RSM Archer. Paddy Archer, they called him. He was our regimental sergeant major. Now, that's the first time any of us had met a regimental sergeant major. And he was the top of the branch. He was a good man. But the discipline came on again. On the parade ground, he was a bastard. He was. On the parade ground, he was the wickedest man you could ever meet. And yet, socially, and he used to socialise with us, come in. He couldn't, you see, we could invite him into a pub, right? But if he walked into a pub and there was a couple of guardsmen at the bar, he had to walk out. See, discipline come in it again. He mustn't associate in a communal place with guardsmen. But you could, as a guardsman, you could invite him in for a drink. That was another, the discipline side of it. So that goes for corporals, lance sergeants, because there was no lance sergeants in the guards. They're all full sergeants or corporals, or full corporals. No lance corporals, no lance sergeants. There was a full corporal, and there was a full sergeant, and there was a drill sergeant, and then there was a sergeant major.
Now, how were these NCOs compared to how they'd been at Chelsea? Were they better or worse, or how did they treat you? Was it the same?
Well, you see, we was thrown together. We was thrown together in the training battalion more so than at Chelsea. At Chelsea, you was up against a brick wall. But these other people, although it wasn't allowed, fraternisation wasn't allowed between non-commissioned officers or commissioned officers and the guardsmen, but you did get a little bit matey now and again, if I can say that word. You can get a little bit matey. There was a little bit of you could have a conversation with them and all that, like about ordinary things that's happening in the world, you know. But on the parade ground, so that was it. You was there to do as you're told, and that was it. But you could go on parade and do a parade, and the sergeant would come up to you and talk to you, but he wouldn't tread on your toes, or he wouldn't spit on your cap badge or anything like that to tarnish it. The same as they would at Chelsea Barracks, because that all come under, you were disciplined there. Now, when you was a trained guardsman, you left that bad discipline behind.
Now what about
you're sort of coming out into the world.
What about your officers? Did you see much of them? What did you think of them?
Right. At Purbright, no, we didn't have a lot of contact with the officers. The only time we ever see the officers, because the officers were, they wasn't called officers, they were called, what do they call them? I'll think of the word in a minute.
Cadets?
Not cadets, no.
Doesn't matter, come back to you.
See, they were under training the same as we were, and they were training to do what they was for, like picket duties and inspecting the guards and that sort of thing. So that's where the only time we came into contact with them is, say, on a weapon inspection. You'd have a young ensign, they called him. A young ensign, he'd come along, and because he was in, he was training as well. He was training to become an officer. And he would inspect the barrel of your rifle and look down it and look at your shoes, look at your blood, and either give you the thumbs up or turn round to the sergeant take that man's name or take his name, and his cap star's not shining or his barrel's out. And then again, when you've done a make-out guard, you'd be out in the field somewhere guarding a barrel or a log on the ground that's supposed to have been a pair of gates. And then during your spell, 2 on and 4 off, you'd have a visit come round by the picket officer. And he'd come round and see that you wasn't fast asleep or something like that. But you see, he's doing his job as well. He's training for his job as well as an officer. All that sort of thing. And you had all that at Purbright.
And how long were you at Purbright for? You'd gone there round about September. How long were you there for?
At Purbright, we wasn't there as long as we should have been because this tank effort came bursting in on us.
So when would it be, do you think? Roughly?
I suppose 6 months. 6 months we'd be there.
Where did you go then?
Well, we returned back to London to Grange Farm, what they called Grange Farm at Chigwell in Essex. We were distributed at Grange Farm, which was a big house taken over by the army, and the officers' quarters was around the Roebuck Hotel. That was a pub up by Epping Forest, on the edge of Epping Forest. Now, that's when we met Captain Willie Whitelaw. He took over as the 3rd Battalion Scots Guards, Tank Battalion Scots Guards. We were training on tanks then.
What, at Grange Farm, or is that just where you...
No, we were just being arranged as a battalion.
That was where the unit was formed?
Yeah, we were being formed as a battalion.
And you were one of the drafts?
We were split up into the various billets, and we had the run of sort of Epping Forest training, but we had no vehicles, we had no tanks. We only had our tanks when we went to Codford, St Mary's.
Now, what kind of training were you doing in Epping Forest?
Just ordinary infantry training. Just ordinary infantry training. Look, well, it was a bit of rough and tumble. You had a forest there, you had a lot of trees, and you were doing training in camouflaging a big object, like a truck. We used the trucks as big objects.
Now tell me how you'd camouflage a truck then. What was a camouflage? What would you do to
We was cutting the branches of trees and that sort of thing and just smothering so that they couldn't be seen from the air and things like that. And
Were you using scrim or anything
like that? No, we did use army scrim as much as we could get, but we subsidised it by breaking branches off the trees and that sort of thing, leaving leaves and branches, that sort. But just general outside shrubbery.
Did you do any tactical training, you know, advancing, retreating, just sort of normal infantry tactical training?
Mostly, we didn't do any drills because we had no drill ground. We took over civilian houses and that. We'd be billeted all round.
What were the billets like? Tell us about the billets.
The billets, well, Thoresby Hall, I called it, one of them.
What about your one, though? That's what I mean. Your billet.
My billet, well, it was a big house, a big mansion, and we were all sectioned off, because obviously the sergeants and the corporal, the lance corporals, and we still had a bloody trained soldier with us, what they called a trained soldier. He was a sort of nursemaid, but they had the best rooms, and we just slept on the floor with a blanket and a pillow, just on the bare boards. But it wasn't very nice. We wasn't there for very long either. I think it was just a way, a couple of months. It was just a way of getting us all together as a team, as a unit.
Now,
and then we went on to Codford St Mary.
And what were you doing at college? This is where you got your training as a tank driver?
We was under Nissanuts at Codford St Mary. And this is where we got our tank training. We got our tanks come along then. And of course, we had a nearby Salisbury Plains. And we was taught how to drive them, how to maintain them, how to look after them.
And this tank was a Churchill? The Churchill tank, was it?
Churchill's, yeah. Yeah, we only had We had a couple of old Valentines and Covenanters, but they were so old and useless that they were just used for training.
So how did they teach you to drive the tank? Which tank did they start you on?
Well, first off, we had a Covenanter. A Covenanter, which was an old tank left over from the last war. But it was usable. It was a runner. So we got climbed in as a driver, because I was down as a driver. They already told me that, because I had mechanical knowledge and I'd been a van driver before the war. Anyway, you had to traverse the turret around so that the driver could lift his hatchway. Because the driver went in. The only man who entered the tank from the outside, other than through the top turret. So you lifted the driver's lid up, as you called it, and down he went. Now, you sat in an iron drum, a big iron drum it was, and when they had to traverse the turret again over the driver's head, so that the co-driver could get in. Although on a Covenant, you see, they didn't have a co-driver, so we can leave that out. But then you had the change, the gear change. Oh, you started the engine up by the normal procedure of pressing a button to start. That started the engine up. Now you've got two levers like big handles. That's the steering levers, and the gear lever. Oh, he was the villain. It was a gate change, not like the things change themselves these days. But in that gate change, you had to use brute force and swear words to get your gear in. You had to visually force it in. And to change gear, you had to do the same forcing to pull it out of gear, through the gate and back the gate. But you had a four-speed gearbox, although speed doesn't come into tank driving, it's just moving. The tank will go along and use a gallon of petrol for half a mile.
How did it work?
The steering just worked on what they called epicyclic gearing. You pull the lever, and it reversed one track and accelerated the other track, and vice versa, the other way around. But you could pull one lever. And it, sometimes it took you, depending on what sort of soil you was on, you could pull one lever which would stop the right-hand track and accelerate the left-hand to turn you on a spin on what we called a button, spin on a button. Normally, as you're going along the road, you just gently touched the levers and you could steer gradual like the steering wheel of a car.
Did it take long to get the hang of it?
It didn't take me long, because I was a driver, and it come to me. But it did some of the chaps who had never been in a vehicle before. But I was lucky, because I was a motor driver and been driving on the roads. But anyway, you all had to start off as if you'd never been in a tank before. You all had to start from scratch. Whether you was a lorry driver or a car driver or what, you had to forget that, because you're in the army now and you've got to do what you're told. Don't do what you want to do, do what you're told. That was, of course, it was a good thing, because if you're driving a 48 or 50 ton tank, Churchill tank, along a road, you could knock a row of houses down within minutes.
You started on the Covenanter now. How far would you go in the Covenanter before you switched to the Churchill?
It all depended how you got along. The instructor could suss whether you was going to make it or you wasn't going to make it. If you wasn't going to make it, you got the elbow again. You was out. But that was why we spent the time at Codford, to sort out the chaff from the corn sort of thing.
Did you switch to the Churchill while you were in training then?
I did, yes.
What was the Churchill like? Yeah. Can you describe that? Because the Churchill is really important to your story. Describe the whole tank and the way it's put together and what the crew did and everything?
Well, as I said before, the Churchill started their life at Vauxhall Motors at Luton, because they were made and built and sent to Vauxhall Motors without an engine in it. So Vauxhall Motors had the job of finding an engine to fit that bloody great big hole, which they did. They found the Merlin. It came out of a, it was built for a craft, you know, on the sea to drive a boat. But anyway, it was a V engine, double ignition, double set of plugs, double set of pistons. Everything was double, because if one lot broke down, you would still run it. But the same Churchill used 2 gallon of petrol for 1 mile travel.
Now, what was it like? What was the layout inside?
The layout was more or less the same. You had the driver's entrance at the front, he's flap, and you could only get in it if the gun was traversed away. That's why I'm wearing a hearing aid now, because that gun, when it fired, was over your head. And in them days, nobody worried about your eardrums or ear flaps or anything like that. But that was the Churchill. The Churchill had the same four-speed gearbox, hand-driven, not like the automatics now. As I say, you had to fight the gear lever to get the gear in.
Very similar again to the Covenant.
Exactly the same, yeah. The same levers to pull, although I think on the Churchill, they wasn't bent levers, they were straight up and down levers, you know, perpendicular, forward and back. But the same episode of gearing at the back operated the tracks. You slowed one down, and as one slowed down, the other one speeded up, and vice versa.